Hi everyone, Jason here. On May the 14th, Stephen and myself will be appearing with the one and only Mark Lewison at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary, Dublin. We're going to be celebrating 60 years of A Hard Day's Night, and we would love you to join us. For tickets, go to paviliontheatre.ie or nothingisrealpod.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And today we're going to be talking about Please Please Me, the debut album from the Beatles. And as we mentioned in our I Want to Hold Your Hand episode, sometimes people focus in on the latter half of the Beatles' career because there's lots of intrigue and lots of things taking a long period of time. But really, the early part of the Beatles' career is just as worthy of discussion. And Please Please Me is a very unique album. And even if the Beatles had only done their 1963 work and then disappeared, I think we'd still be talking about them today as a very fantastic curiosity. So Please Please Me, I'm assuming you're a fan of the album, Stephen.
I am. And ahead of recording this, I went back and I listened to it again in its various sort of iterations, the original vinyl, the 1987 CD, and the 2009 remaster. And it's an album that I keep rediscovering. I keep forgetting just how good it is.
Yeah. And I think one key reason I wanted to talk about it today is that I feel that often it's written that it's the Rubber Soul, Revolver, Sgt. Pepper axis that the Beatles became an albums act. And I don't think that's true. I think they became an albums act right at the very start. That Please Please Me, yes, it's technologically connected to 1963, but it's as good an album as anything. And if you kind of look at what was happening around at the same time, it is a game changer as an album.
Yeah, I think that's right. What strikes me is that, as you said, it's sort of its time, but you can see it pushing past what was in the charts at that time. Mm. It's also interesting because it's probably the widest spread in terms of the variety of songs. So you've got rock and roll songs, you've got a show tune, you've got girl groups, you've got R&B. And really what they're doing right from the beginning, which I suppose reflects their live act at the time, is they're being influenced by absolutely everything that's going on around them.
Yeah,
they're distilling the essence of those sort of girl group harmonies, the Chuck Berry riffs, and they're turning it into something new.
Yeah,
putting their own spin on it.
Well, that is the brilliant thing about it, because they're not being influenced by being the Beatles, so to speak.
No.
Yet they're kind of coming clean. So the expectation is a different expectation to later albums. They're really just presenting themselves. They haven't been sullied, if you want to say, by huge amounts of fame, by worldwide adulation yet. They are literally saying, here we are.
Yeah, I think so. I think their interest is simply in presenting themselves. This is their first sort of presentation to the public. And I think, yes, to that extent, because their sort of rise was so meteoric, you genuinely don't get that.
Yeah.
Again, they're not writing songs to order. They're not writing songs because they've got to have an American hit. This is just what they were doing at the time.
Yeah. So if you kind of look at the numbers, the Please Please Me album, famously it gets said that it was recorded in a day, which isn't strictly speaking 100% true, but we'll come to that in a second. When it does come out eventually, it comes out on the 22nd of March 1963, and it gradually over the next couple of weeks gets to number one, and it gets to number one in the UK on the 5th of May 1963, and it stays there for 30 weeks, and the only thing that's big enough to replace it is the Beatles. With the Beatles, when that comes out on the 1st of December 63, their second album, and then that stays there for 21 weeks. So there's this 1 year block where the Beatles are number one with these two albums. And if you know, when we talk about how important it is as an album, if you look at the UK album charts at that time. And, you know, it's important to remember that singles were massively outselling albums at that time. But when Please Please Me gets to number one, it starts this kind of 3.5 year block where the only number one albums are The Beatles, The Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, and The Sound of Music soundtrack. So, you know, for people to say that it's later when the albums kick in, that's a kind of a revolutionary change in the album charts, that these people
they
get to number one.
They just dominate the singles and album charts. Yeah.
And if you look at the year before that, it's all Cliff Richard and The Shadows are taking up most of the weeks in the charts. Yeah. So it's a hugely influential album. And it's worth remembering that in 1963, the Beatles were busy. They played 217 gigs that year. They had a radio show on the BBC that used to go out Tuesdays at 5 p.m. called Pop Go the Beatles. And, you know, they're kind of taking over from, as a Cliff and the Shadows had been the main leaders before that. And Cliff and the Shadows are mentioned in the sleeve notes of Please Please Me. It says, if I look at the quote here, they're the most exciting and accomplished group, i.e. the Beatles are the most exciting and accomplished group to emerge since the Shadows.
High praise.
High praise indeed, you know. And, you know, because everyone was waiting for a new Shadows. And the other thing that the sleeve notes of the album say is that they have enough self-penned numbers to maintain a steady output of all original singles from now until 1975.
That's kind of spooky, 1975.
Why is that spooky?
Because that's when their contract eventually ran out.
Wasn't it 76? No?
75, end of 75.
Oh, okay. Stickler for detail. What's kind of quaint about that is how far away they think 1975 is. I don't think that there was any similar notes on the back of Shadows Records at the time. So, as I said, it's often said that it's recorded in one day, but it's really recorded on the back of the two previous singles, isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a 14-track album. Four of the 14 tracks are recorded in advance, and the first two are "Love Me Do" and "P.S. I Love You," which comes out as a single towards the end of 1962, and that pushes the need for the second follow-up single, which is "Please Please Me," backed with
"Ask Me Why."
Ask Me Why.
It's like a pop quiz. I'm being,
And what do we learn from the recording sessions of those singles? Because obviously, famously, the "Love Me Do" session is the one where Andy White, we have the two versions of "Love Me Do."
So the story is, this is Ringo's sort of debut recording session with the Beatles, and he comes in very keen to impress. I suppose probably impress the band as well as impress George Martin.
Well, it's also worth Pete Best at the previous session hadn't really impressed anyone, and the Pete Best version of "Love Me Do" is on Beatles Anthology One.
Yeah,
and it's
poor.
Oh my gosh,
it is pretty poor.
Pete Best sounds like a horse walking downstairs.
Yeah,
it is
falling downstairs. Yes. There's a lot of people that still have that sort of, oh well, you know, Pete Best was a decent drummer. He was pretty good. I think the recorded evidence that you have there, yeah, maybe it's studio nerves, but it really comes across that he just...
Well, this is a theory about Pete Best, yeah, is that the studio, he could not make it count in the studio, which is kind of important, but is not uncommon with bands of the 60s where they would be getting session ears in and saying, look, do what you do on the road, but in here we're going to play it in a studio way.
Well, the interesting thing, going back to the very first time the Beatles were in a studio in Germany, with Bert Kampfert recording with Tony Sheridan, it's Pete Best drumming that Kampfert takes exception to, and he removes the bass drum, I think, so that Pete Best is limited, you know, because clearly that kind of, you know, can't coordinate the bass drum and the tom-toms and the cymbals. So second time in the studio for Pete Best, second producer to say the drummer isn't up to scratch. So Ringo has come in. He was obviously getting a lot of flack. The band were getting a lot of flack back home in Liverpool from the fans. He's eager to please. And I think there's a story that he tells about, you know, he's sitting there with the drumsticks in his hand, plus maracas, plus a tambourine. He's trying to do all these things at once and really just making a bit of a mess of that.
Yeah.
George Martin would say that he didn't know
Ringo
they were coming in with a new drummer.
Yeah.
So he had already booked Andy White on the basis that Pete Best wasn't up to scratch.
Mm-hmm.
They brought in a new drummer. Andy White was already booked for the session. Martin wasn't going to take any chances, but Ringo, I think, didn't particularly cover himself in glory simply by being overly keen, I think.
It is a curious thing, and, you know, I know books have been written about the whole Pete Best situation, that, you know, many other bands might have just said, well, you know, we'll just do the session drummer and Pete will stay in the band and that's that. But the Beatles kind of are so... I know John Lennon called themselves as bastards in those days, but they were so focused, and I think they'd come to a point with Pete anyway that they decided, well, this is the leverage we need. You know, we will get a new drummer. We won't try and hide it up. And I believe that any good band in history is only as good as its drummer, and cometh the hour, cometh Ringo, who made the difference.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's true to say that, that they had been thinking of getting rid of Pete for a while. I mean, he was there, I think, under sufferance. you know, his mother provided them with a venue initially in Hamburg. He was off doing his own thing, so the other three became very tight. He just was not the same personality as the rest of them. I think they'd been talking about this for a while.
Yes. He also was never, well, this is something that Mark Lewisohn makes quite clear in his biography, is that he wasn't socially adept to hanging out with the Japage three, if you want to say.
No, I mean, yes, in Hamburg, he sort of went off. He had a girlfriend. He went off, hung out with her. The other three were kind of...
hanging with Ringo, with his band.
Hanging with Ringo and other musicians. So I think there was that element, but I you do get the very clear sense that George Martin, having said this drummer isn't good enough, that was the sort of final piece, if not the reason for him going. It provided the excuse or the pretext to say to Brian Epstein, you must now get rid of him.
So September 62, Ringo turns up and Andy White is there as a session drummer, and we now have this thing where we have two versions of Love Me Do to compare to. And so the single version, which is the version that ends up on Past Masters these days, if you want to hear it, is the version where Ringo plays drums.
Yes.
And the Andy White version is the version that actually ends up going onto the album. I'm not exactly sure how they came to that switch.
No, that seems to me to be counterintuitive.
Yeah, that they wouldn't keep Ringo on the album after he proved himself.
If the single was good, if it was good enough for the single, why not just use that version and consign the Andy White to the shelf?
And if you're ever forced to figure out which the difference is the tambourine.
Yeah.
So in the Andy White version, Ringo's just tapping a tambourine. And in the non...
forlornly in the background.
Yeah, you can hear his sad face
slowly
tapping it. And in the tambourineless version, that's Ringo on drums. So listen out for that tambourine. And then Andy White is drumming on the B-side as well,
PS I Love You. And there Ringo is on Maracas.
Great Maracas.
Fantastic Maracas. Highlight.
So the Love Me Do single begat another single, which was Please Please Me.
Mm-hmm.
And so that gets recorded then in December. And for release in January, and that's Please Please Me backed with Ask Me Why. And this time Ringo is fully on drums. It is the four of them recording. And so as one single begats another single, this second single then begats the need for an album. So George Martin has a couple of ideas for the, you know, trying to figure out the album, but his main idea is just wanting to capture them as they are. They're playing, they've got a massive repertoire of songs, and they're playing in the Cavern Club. They're starting to play up and down the country, and he kind of wants to capture that spirit in a bottle, isn't that it?
Yeah, that's it. So they actually visit the Cavern.
Yeah.
I think George Martin said, almost immediately he walked in the door, he thought, this is not going to work. You know, as a venue, it's small, it's cramped, the acoustics are terrible, he's not going to be able to get a satisfactory live recording there. So that was, I think, abandoned fairly early doors.
I it's one of the lost things, isn't it, that we don't have a, you know, 61, 62 recording, particularly, you know, a decent recording of the kind of the leather clad rock and roll Beatles. But I for all the kind of teary-eyed reminiscences about the Cavern, it must have been bad acoustically, or must have been a hard place to...
I suspect it's one of those things, you really had to be there.
Yes.
And possibly, you know, with hindsight, it was more about the emotion than the sort of finesse of the musical performances. But still, you know, if you had a choice to go back and see any gig...
Yeah.
You know, that might be the place to go.
No, I think you're absolutely right. But again, George Martin's kind of care in this issue is one of these kind of lucky things that the Beatles have going for them. You know, they've got a very thoughtful producer. They've got a very thoughtful manager. You know, there's many other managers who would have said, get a tape in here, get the album out next week. Let's put out something shoddy. These guys are in the top 10. But George Martin is saying, you know, let's just take a week or two and gather our thoughts and do something properly. yeah. which is to all their credit.
It is, I think, and I think, you know, I know it's a sort of the old chestnut about the fifth Beatle, but I mean, really, if they didn't have George Martin as a producer, you think just how different, you know, things might have been. I always draw a comparison with the Kinks, where you've got a songwriter like Ray Davies, who is, you know, arguably the equal of Lennon and McCartney in that 60s peak. But yet the Kinks records just don't sound great.
No, they don't.
Or even the early Who records.
Yeah, don't sound great.
Because they don't, and the Stones the same. So until Jimmy Miller comes in with the Stones in the late 60s, they just don't sound good.
It does take a lot of, it does take time for all those people to pull up. Like you take, let's just take a sidestep to the Who, for instance. Mm. Tommy doesn't sound like it's recorded the same year as Abbey Road.
No.
And, you know, it's only when Glyn Johns comes in for Who's Next that you get kind of a proper dynamic
it's
recorded sound.
It's a complete sea change in the sound.
And again, you know, you're kind of looking at 66 and the Beatles, or the Kinks are number one with Sunny Afternoon. Fantastic song, charming recording. But it's not as crystal clear as, say, Good Day Sunshine from Revolver, which is coming out at the same time as well. So they were always, they were very lucky.
The producer, the production style and the production, the attention to detail and the preparedness of George Martin to work with the band, allow them to experiment and translate, his ability to translate what they wanted. Mm. You know, at this stage, obviously, George Martin is pretty much calling the shots in the studio. But I think the production here, even at this early stage.
And he's also, like, George is producing great records for other people as well. I remember a few years ago I was listening to a compilation and this song called Shadows and Reflection by The Action came on. I went, that's a fantastic song. And I look up the notes, George Martin production, you know, he is streets ahead of other people at the time. And so you think, we have those two songs in the can, Love Me Do and Please Please Me. And Please Please Me is still a great song, isn't it? I mean, it's you really get that Beatles harmony thing where they create like a third note between their two voices when they're singing in the choruses together, or the verses together.
It is. I mean, I always thought Love Me Do is the kind of outlier, that it doesn't really sound like anything they would do subsequently. It's not really a Beatlemania style, prefiguring that. But Please Please Me, it seems to me that is really where it starts, and that's the song.
But it's a lovely 62-63 divide.
It
it's
is
like 62,
it is.
Start the engine, 63, let's go.
And this is famously the song that was written as a sort of in a ballad style, that kind of Roy Orbison style, which, you know, you would dearly love to hear what that
could have been.
What that could have been.
Yeah.
You know, I and that was widely known that it was written in that style even in the early 60s, and I'm thinking, Roy Orbison never thought, I might cover that and do it in my own style. But Please Please Me is the song that sent Dick James, kind of got his antennae quivering and thought, right, we're gonna form a music company, a publishing company. So that's the song that really grabbed his attention. And there's a nice little review of that single. This was in the NME, and it says, it's a really enjoyable platter full of beat, vigor and vitality. No, nothing you can disagree with.
And here we are, whatever, almost 60 years later, trying to fill an hour talking about it when they've kind of nailed it. And the other thing that I love about Please Please Me is Ringo's fills at the end. You know, like he's really announcing himself. Of course he's essential to that band. Andy White wouldn't have done something like that. And it's, you know, that's born from show work and stage work.
He brings a character that a session drummer wouldn't bring.
Yeah. So they have these two singles and the associated B-sides in the bag. And when the album comes out, side one finishes with Please Please Me with those Ringo fills. Side two opens with Love Me Do. And the B-sides are right next to them on the album as well. But they've got 10 more songs to fill. So George Martin arranges for them to come into the studio, Abbey Road Studio 2, where they try and record the rest of the album in one day. And that's in February 1963. And they arrive at about 10 o'clock in the morning. And I think it's a bit instructive, instead of going through the album in terms of what's on the album, to kind of go through it in terms of the order they recorded things in. Because the first thing they record that day is There's a Place. And I think There's a Place is, when you end up listening to the album, even though it's the second last track on the album, it's a song that kind of marks them out as being ahead of other people. It's a song that says, there's a place I can go, it's my mind.
Yeah.
And you can think it's a love song, but actually it's quite It's got a depth to it that you wouldn't expect.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. It's quite a mature lyric.
Yeah.
I think supposedly there's a song in West Side Story, There's a Place for Us.
Oh, yes.
That's where the title came from. Paul said, you know, it's pretty much a joint composition and vocal. Paul is really sort of prominent there, although John is maybe the main author of the song.
Yeah, and it's interesting because obviously at the start of the day, John's voice is still holding up, so they're starting with some John recordings because we'll talk about his voice going as the day goes on.
Yeah, I mean he famously had a cold, and I think you can hear that even in this first song.
Yeah,
there's like 12 or 13 takes for this to get this one right.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to sort of think what was in their mind when they were recording this, and it sort of
there was a place in their mind, Steve.
There was a place. can we cut that? So you know they've got 13 passes at the first song of the day.
Yeah,
and you sort of think, were they thinking this is going to be a slog? 13 seems a lot.
I'm just looking at 10 takes.
Yeah,
they had 10 takes done on that one, but even still, to actually. They couldn't be going at that rate for the whole day. And the thing is, you know, part of the reason we're talking about this album is to try and drive people back to listen to it again.
Mm.
But there's a bit on, you know, when they hit that harmony about 1 minute, 50 seconds in, and It's My Mind, the two of them, they kind of, it's one of these John and Paul moments where it just jumps out of the speakers at you. But yeah, they eventually do kind of put it down. But I think as a song, it's kind of the key to them. If you're trying to look back and say, were there any clues on the first album about where they were going to go? Well, you know, there's a place, there's a connection to Turn Off Your Mind, Relax and Float Downstream.
Yeah.
You know,
The seeds are there. It reminds me slightly in the context of the lyric of In My Room.
Yes.
Which is the Brian Wilson Beach Boys song. This song, There's a Place, got to number 2 in the US single charts.
By the Beatles?
By the Beatles.
I did not know that.
They're backed with Twist and Shout.
Goodness me.
On the Tolly label.
Really?
Yeah.
The US Beatles experience is a... Well, we should talk about that briefly because in a way there is not a US version per se of the Please Please Me album.
No.
There's a parallel, you could say, well, with the Beatles is kind of Meet the Beatles.
Yeah.
And you can kind of look at matches. But again, it's an album that hasn't, not only is it not affected by the American experience when they record it, there isn't really a parallel album. I know they have the early Beatles album, but it's a different
sort of
thing.
It is, and they sort of backtracked.
Yes.
So it was really, they were the Capitol were going back to mine those earlier sides.
Yeah.
After the sort of Beatlemania had hit in America.
Yeah.
So no, there's no direct equivalent.
And even the cover is different. So like we kind of have a cultural of them looking over the balcony. We have a cultural connection to that perhaps wasn't there in the early days of American Beatlemania. So they record There's a Place, and then the next song they stand there they record on the day is a song called 17, which is a working title of I Saw Her Standing There, obviously. And this is a very new song actually at the time. Paul kind of writes it at the end of 62, and I think he figures out quite quickly that this is a good song.
Yes, yeah. So he recalls the fact that this was written in Forthland Road in the living room of his father's house. And Paul's idea, but he does sort of say, you know, it was really a bit of a co-write.
Yeah.
There's that Lennon coming up with the she was just 17, you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Never been a beauty queen.
Where Paul's original, never been a beauty queen. I think there were a couple of other things, you know, man, she was mean.
Yes.
And then suddenly Lennon hits on this, and then there's a kind of suggestive element to that as well. And there's actually, if we can find it, we can maybe put it on the Facebook and on Twitter, that Mike McCartney, Paul's brother, took a photograph of them in Forthland Road on that day, hunched over like an exercise book.
So that's the song they're working on in that famous picture of the two of them, guitar to guitar.
Yeah, where they're kind of working on that particular song. So if we can find that, we can maybe put that up on. The other aspect of that I like about this song is it's a standard. It's a rock and roll standard.
Yes.
So right off the bat, the first album, first song that you hear, that's become a rock and roll standard.
Yeah.
That's a song that other people will go to 50 years later in the way they go to Johnny B. Goode or you know, any number of those kind of 50s songs.
But it does show, you're absolutely right, and it shows that antenna that I think they knew, oh, we've written a song in this idiom and it's as good as anything else. Obviously, it ends up as the opening track on the album. you know, the things we kind of take for granted about the Beatles, you know, we take for granted their counting. You know, it's their first album, yeah. their first song, 1, 2, 3, 4, and away they go. And it's very exciting. And it's, you know, as I said, it sounds in the great tradition of a lot of Beatles songs and Paul McCartney songs. It has this thing where where he's written a song and you feel like you've heard it before.
Yeah. Because he stole the bass line from Chuck Berry.
Well, there's you were talking earlier on about you've listened to the 2009 versions and the 87 versions and all the rest. The 2009 versions, when you're talking about bass, the remasters that came out at, in 2009 are, you know, the bass is slightly turned up. I wonder why.
Yes.
But you hear the bass on I Saw Her Standing There, and it's a song Paul still sings in concert. And to watch him play bass, it's extraordinary.
It is. It's absolutely phenomenal. That's the thing that really sort of leaps out at you in the 2009 remasters is the bass playing.
Yeah.
I mean, I hold my hand up and say, yeah, you know, even at that stage, that very first album, McCartney's bass playing on this throughout the album, but on is just phenomenal.
It is phenomenal.
And if there was ever any need to justify the remastering, it's the bass playing.
Yeah. And George Martin, famously, he would be, in the early days, the sequencing was purely up to him. Mm. And he used to put a song at the start of side one, which you would call a potboiler, or something exciting, something to get the juices going. And I think nothing delivers better in that regard than I Saw Her Standing There. And it never was a single, well, certainly official single. I'm sure it hit the charts in the US, it never was an official single.
No, but as I say, it's a standard. So it's Lennon famously did it with Elton John
in 74.
There's a very entertaining clip of McCartney at one of the Prince's Trust concerts, and he's singing this, and Brian Adams, who you may remember, Brian Adams had a hit, he steps forward to sing it with McCartney, and the grin on his face just to be standing next to McCartney and singing that song. So it's become,
but it's also like the Elton John Thanksgiving 74 Lennon performance is great fun. It's odd to hear Lennon sing it, but the other fantastic performance that's worth checking out is Last Play at Shea, where Billy Joel invites Paul McCartney on to sing I Saw Her Standing There, and we'll put up a link to the clip. It's a fantastic thing because they're closing down Shea Stadium. They're going to demolish it. The last gig is Billy Joel. There's rumours that McCartney's going to turn out. He's got a private plane rushing him to the stadium. And the joy in the stadium, the place just erupts when McCartney walks on stage and they sing I Saw Her Standing There, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I thought you were going to reference the Beatles induction into the Hall of Fame, which you should check that out well.
Is that
that's where they have a stage full of people, primarily Mick Jagger, doing a really terrible ramshackle version. You were just saying about, you know, the vitality of this. Ian MacDonald has a great quote.
Oh yeah,
and he says this song called the bluff of the chintz merchants of Denmark Street.
That's fantastic.
And I thought that's absolutely on the money.
Well, you talk about it being a standard, and you know, there's some other songs that they put on the album later on, you know, that we'll talk about becoming standards as well. But it lends to this notion of they are putting top drawer material on an album, which is a format that sells less than singles, stuff that could have been singles. So of course this is a game changer for albums in general. They record those two songs, they take a break at lunchtime, and the famous story goes that instead of the Beatles taking a break at lunchtime, they keep recording they keep rehearsing in Studio 2 while all the engineers go off for their lunch. And then the second session, the afternoon session, begins at 2:30. And the next song they record is A Taste of Honey, which, you know, on the final album, you know, it's tucked in near the end, and it's probably a song that most people don't like.
Yeah, I have to say, my notes here, I've written low point. So I think this using of show tunes doesn't really survive very long. You know, you've got Till There Was You on with the Beatles.
But,
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
But they are trying to capture that. We're doing a bit of everything.
Exactly,
on the album.
Exactly. And as you say, what you've got to remember is the big hits, the big soundtrack albums are Sound of Music, South Pacific.
Yeah.
So show tunes for the mums and dads, for the general. You know, we haven't, I suppose, really kind of got in the UK that distinction yet. That generational distinction.
Yes.
And to an extent, you know, one of my theories is that generation gap.
Yeah.
Didn't open up as quickly as it would have done because of the Beatles.
Right, yes.
Because they were consistently producing songs and albums that the teenagers liked, the young kids liked, the mums and dads liked,
the
grannies liked.
There was articles in the papers that the grown-ups could attach to. Well, I don't mind these Beatles, but these other bands.
Yes,
are,
yes. Yeah. And this is a prime example, but I have to say, Taste of Honey is definitely...
Do you know, though, the connection between A Taste of Honey and Star Wars?
Star Wars. No.
So A Taste of Honey was first recorded by Billy Dee Williams for a play in 1960. And Billy Dee Williams was Lando Calrissian. We almost got a shout out there from producer Ada that it's Lando Calrissian. And he recorded the first version because it was a part of a play in 1960. It was released in 61. And there was a version by a chap called Lenny Walsh in 1962, which is the version that the Beatles probably... took their inspiration from. There's a couple of nice things about it, though. So even if you listen to it, it has that nice tempo change where it kind of goes into this swing. You know, it's there to give a little bit of colour to the, you know, it's not an album full of A Taste of Honey. So
no.
I'm glad it does its function. You know, Ringo swings nicely through it. And it has these great kind of bits of Paul double tracking himself. And that's a little technological glance into the future.
Yeah, that's a little glimpse into the way Paul would want it going forward.
A whole band of Pauls. How exciting would that be? So they get A Taste of Honey down, and then next up to stand up to the microphone is George Harrison, who is singing another song that I think has evolved into a standard, which is Do You Want to Know a Secret?
Yeah.
I remember when I got Please Please Me for the first time, and as I think I've said before, I was a kind of a kid of late 80s Beatles on CD, and I bought a lot of the later albums. So Please Please Me, I bought quite late in the sequence because I was listening to all the cool, funky albums. And I remember buying Please Please Me in Dublin Airport. And I was a teenager and I listened to this on the Discman. And when it came on to Do You Want to Know a Secret, I had that wave of, oh, I didn't know this was a Beatles song. I know this song. And that's kind of how it exists,
and
that
which,
song.
Which person were you thinking of?
I don't know. It was just one of those songs that was in the ether. And it's like, oh, this is a Beatles song. And it's another little song that's developed into a standard.
Yeah,
know?
I think the interesting thing is McCartney doesn't rate this song at all.
Really?
Yeah, I went back and I looked at his Many Years From Now, and he said this is just a hack song. This is a 50-50 co-write, he says. It's just a hack song. We had to write something for George. And Lennon said, we wrote this specifically for George. It's only got three notes because George isn't the best singer in the world.
But, you know, again, you start picking it apart and it's got loads of great bits. It has that... I don't know, I'm sure there's a musical technical term for it, but it has that kind of introductory melody that he does again with them Here, There and Everywhere.
Yep.
And maybe Queenie Eye, I don't know, where there's kind of an introductory kind of melody that doesn't get repeated in the rest of the song. And that's kind of, it reminds me of things like Mario Lanza, I guess, and all these kind of great balladeers, you know.
And again, can I say number two single?
For Billy J. Kramer, was it? Or for them?
For the Beatles.
Oh, the Beatles.
The Billy J. Kramer, I think, took it to number one.
Yeah.
But in America, the Beatles version got to number two. That was on the VJ label.
Well, there you go. And that's George's debut vocal on a Beatles album.
And can I just say, before we leave that, George referenced a song by a group called The Stereos, called I Really Love You. It's not a song that I was familiar with. It was a hit in 1961. And he has said, if you want to know where we took this song from, go and listen to that earlier version. And he actually recorded a version of that in 1982 on Gone Troppo, which sounds nothing Like, do you want to know a secret?
I did not know that. Now I have to go off and listen to that. So with those songs finished, they're still in their afternoon session, and the final song they record in the afternoon session is Misery, which ends up being the second track on the album, and as such is kind of the first time you hear Lennon sing on the album. And it was originally famously written and offered to Helen Shapiro, but she didn't want to take it.
Well, she never heard it.
Oh, it never even made it to her ears.
Never even made it. So seemingly they were, it was just before their first UK tour,
yeah.
Which was in February 1963. They were fifth on the bill. And they say they started it backstage, finished it at Fortland Road.
Yeah.
They gave it not to Helen Shapiro, but it went sort of to her manager and to her producer, who was the infamous Norrie Paramore.
Oh, yeah.
Who was the producer that George Martin had a great rivalry with. Paramore thought wasn't appropriate. Misery, sad, that's not.
Yes.
Helen Shapiro is, you know, walking back to happiness. It's all up tempo songs. And so it was rejected. And then Someone else picked it up.
Who?
Kenny Lynch.
Oh, yes. Kenny Lynch, who was on the tour bus.
He was on the tour bus. So yeah. He heard it
and
thought, I'll be having that. So he became the first person ever to record a cover of a Lennon and McCartney song.
Tough stuff.
It was a minor, minor hit.
On the same tour bus, he heard them writing. We're getting into Scouse speak here. He heard them writing.
We've just lost our Liverpool audience.
I'm terribly sorry. We love Liverpool. We do love Liverpool.
We do.
He heard them writing "I Want to Hold Your Hand" and thought, no, that's not that great.
Yeah.
So what does Kenny Lynch know? If he wants to come on the podcast,
we'd be delighted. Yeah, because is Kenny Lynch on the cover of Band on the Run?
He is.
Ah, there you go.
There you go. So he's all right, Kenny Lynch. He's one of those kind of TV staples I remember from the 80s. That's the last session that they record in, the last song they record in the afternoon session, and then they take another break. And then the third session of the day, because the day would usually be broken up into sessions in Abbey Road for professional musicians, was supposed to run from 7:30 till 10 p.m., and then it ends up overrunning, and we'll come to that in a sec. But the first thing that they record in the evening session, they record 13 takes of Hold Me Tight, and this is one of the great lost Beatles recordings. It's really frustrating. So Hold Me Tight, it doesn't make Please Please Me. It ends up being re-recorded for With the Beatles, and it's another kind of bag of Lennon and McCartney excitement.
Is it?
Do you not like Hold Me Tight?
No.
Oh
no.
Dear.
You mean on With the Beatles?
Yeah.
No, if you be,
but it's too slight, is it?
Apart from Till There Was You, I would say that's probably my low point of okay. With the Beatles.
Well, maybe we'll save it for our With the Beatles dissection.
Heated debate. Okay.
But when they recorded on that day, they found it hard to nail down.
Is that missing?
That's missing. They had plans to edit together two versions. That's what the notes suggest. But apparently the tapes are gone.
Okay.
So we do not have
that. Because I was actually, but whenever you were saying, you know, this is the amazing, lost, mythical tape, I was thinking, well, how good could it be if they preferred the version that ended up on With the Beatles? But okay.
Well, yes, but they so it was a bit stop and start. Then they still have four more songs to record for the album, and they've already recorded one cover version, which was A Taste of Honey, but the rest of the songs that they record for the day are all cover versions. So it's interesting when you kind of look at this overview that, yes, we buy the album and it's a mix of originals and covers, but you look at the day's recording and they're very blatantly, obviously and sensibly recording their own songs up front. And then for the evening session, they're just nailing down all the covers right at the end. And maybe some of these covers are easier to record because they're coming from the stage set. So they're literally not having to think about how they exist. So they record three takes next of Anna, Go to Him, which is a song by Arthur Alexander. Then they do a single one take through of Boys, which is Ringo's vocal appearance on the album.
Yeah.
Now, I think Anna, Go to Him, even though there's talk of John's voice not being great on the day, John's voice on Anna is just one of my favourite things.
It's a great version. And I mean, I've heard the Arthur Alexander version. I think the Beatles probably top that.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that big kind of whoa that he does in that is just a wonderful noise. And there's an Elvis Costello song from many years later called Blue Chair, where he rips that off completely. And when you hear it, it's like, oh, that's John Lennon's Anna, Go to Him, uh-oh-ohs. And then, as I said, they kind of knock through Boys in one take with Ringo drumming and singing. And here's what I think. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I also think that, you know, for all the talk of Pete Best out, Ringo in, what's going on, just, you know, he's only been in the group for weeks, really, four months or 5 months at this time. And already he's Ringo of the Beatles. He has his star time Ringo moment. He's, you know, he's part of the group. He's getting his vocal in. You know, it's a very democratic, and it's the right choice to make as well.
It is. It's a perfect song for Ringo. He still does it live in his all-star tour. And I think it's not perhaps technically the best performance, but it just captures that live feel. I think this is one of those songs on the album which really sort of reflects that initial idea of it would be great to get a live performance, and this is probably as one of the songs that gets you as close to that as possible.
It's always fun to watch him play drums and sing this song at the same
going
crazy
where he's just going completely nuts. So you would get a real sense of that, and it's one of the few songs on the album, if you listen to the sort of 87 CD or the kind of mid-70s fake stereo they're tinkering with, naturally enough his vocals and drums are on one track. So it's impossible to separate the two, and it's a very exciting performance.
Yeah, so you know, Ringo is not like a junior partner. He has a song here. It's the christening of the Ringo song on the album, which is a feature that happens almost on every single Beatles record. And it has that great bit where he just shouts out, "All right, George," you know, this kind of notion of, again, we take it for granted, the Beatles is this kind of four-headed monster. You know, it wasn't X and the Beatles. It wasn't like one of these, you know, Johnny Kidd and the Pirate type things. They are a kind of a one-headed beast or four-headed beast kind of communicating with each other. So then there's more cover versions next. There's Chains, which is a Goffin and King song, and Baby It's You, which is a obviously a Bacharach and David with Williams song. Yeah. And what's interesting is it's early 63, and you know, Goffin and King and Bacharach and David haven't become the big legends that we know about.
No.
But yet, again, the Beatles antenna is tuned into these slightly obscure songs by these people who had gone to be very, very important songwriters.
I think that's very telling. You know, you've got an album here it's got Lennon McCartney, Goffin and King, Burt Bacharach. You know, that's a pretty impressive roster of songwriting.
And decades later, you kind of think, and Lennon McCartney is part of that roster as well. Yeah. Like they're kind of setting out their stall to be part of that. George sings Chains, and Baby It's You eventually comes out as a single in the BBC version in 1994.
George, I mean, you know, Teen George. it's not the most sort of inspiring performance, I think. I think there's a little kind of leaden. It's an interesting track.
Yes. They're rattling through these songs in much less takes. Yeah. So there's four takes of Chains and three takes of Baby It's You.
Baby It's You, I think, is a fantastic song, and I think it's a fantastic performance. I think maybe the BBC version kind of shades this one, but I think this is one of those where Ian MacDonald and I part company. He refers to Baby It's You as ethereal kitsch.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He has his moments.
He has his moments, but I fundamentally disagree. I think that's a kind of hidden gem.
There's, you know, people talk about Please Please Me being recorded in one day, and they record, you know, the 10 songs in one day. Do you know there was another day in 1963 where they recorded more songs in a single day that ended up on record?
Do tell.
It's Wednesday the 10th of July 1963. When they were recording at the BBC for Pop Goes the Beatles.
Okay.
And 12 of those recordings from that day have ended up on various versions of Life at the BBC, Volume 1 and Volume 2. So it's amazing how much they're putting down on taking, including that other version of Baby It's You. So we're at 10 o'clock. The session is supposed to finish. And this is where the Beatles kind of step over into legend, you know, or the myth is created. And they need one more song, because you can't put out a record with 13 tracks. You have to put out a record with 14 tracks. Yeah. And so they have one song left to record. They're running over time. They go off to the canteen. And what I like most about this famous story is that they hadn't decided what they were going to do. Like, they hadn't even turned up with a list of songs.
No. They're sort of deciding on the hoof.
Yeah, what they're going to do. So eventually somebody decides that they should do Twist and Shout. And, you know, we recently you know, podcasted from Abbey Road Studio 2 itself. So well, you describe then how John nails Twist and Shout.
Well, this is this was the moment when we were in Studio 2.
Yeah.
I hold my hand up and say I kind of wandered around for the first hour almost in a day, is not quite believing that I was there and not really quite appreciating what was going on. And but midway through the lecture that we were attending, they started to talk about the sound of the room. Mm. And they said the best example of this is Twist and Shout. And they played really the last little section of Twist and Shout. And you could hear it. And we were sitting 10 feet
yeah.
away from where the Beatles were set up in the corner of the room, diagonally opposite the control room.
Yeah.
And that was a kind of all the hair on the back of my neck was standing up. That was a spine-tingling moment. And it just took me right back to this record. And that's really when as soon as I get home that day, this is the record I put on. So by this stage, John's voice is starting to give out. His cold has kicked in.
Yeah.
So he, you know,
well, they'd been working for 12 hours
yeah,
solid, you know?
Yeah.
And they had one chance to just get it right.
I think this was it. It was going to be such a kind of... that song is not... You're not going to get a second chance
yeah.
at this.
And they had been using it in their touring act as a
yeah.
closer. They knew it had, you know...
Yes, impact.
Power. Yeah.
Impact. So it's a radically different version to the Isley Brothers
yes.
version. And this is a song where it's a cover, but they absolutely made it their own. And
yeah.
I don't think anybody thinks of the Isley Brothers version. This is the definitive take.
It's interesting, you know, it's always curious to look at the top streaming Beatles songs. And the only, you know,
so obviously George song.
George song, Here Comes the Sun, is number one. A lot of the songs are later songs. The only really early song that hits the top 10 is Twist and Shout.
Yeah.
And that could be, I remember it being in Ferris Bueller and that
yeah.
had a bit of an impact
yeah, yeah.
and all the rest. But yeah, it's one that really does carry, and
it does, and
it's still a floor filler, you know.
Absolutely. When you're at the disco, that's you're out on the floor as soon as that comes on.
Always at those discos.
So John is drinking hot milk and sucking
Zoobs, a throat sweet.
I don't know. Do they still make Zoobs?
I don't know.
Can we get sponsored by Zoobs?
Sucking a Zoob is a good name for a podcast, I think.
I don't know. We want to. That's our
yes.
separate podcast. So he takes his shirt off.
Yeah.
He's gargling milk, and we have just our producers showing us pictures of Zoobs.
They still exist.
They seem to still exist.
That's great. Brought to you by Zoobs.
Yeah. Let's get right on that. So it's a live one take in the studio, and you can hear the exuberance.
Yes.
You can hear that they're really going for it.
Yeah.
Lennon said afterwards, I wasn't really singing it. I was just screaming it.
Well, I have a quote from Lennon here from a 76 interview. That last song nearly killed me. My voice wasn't the same for a long time after. Every time I swallowed, it was like sandpaper. I was always bitterly ashamed of it because I could sing it better than that. But now it doesn't bother me. You can hear that I'm just a frantic guy doing his best.
So this is, and it prompted George Martin to say, I don't know how they do it. We've been recording all day. The longer we go
yeah.
on, the better they get. Now, they did start a second take.
Well, this is the big revelation, I remember,
yeah.
when Lewis and Sessions' book came out in 88, was that. And it's never leaked. It's never been bootlegged. But it just, I would hate to hear it.
Well, I was just going to say, I would love to hear it.
I would hate to hear it. I would hate to hear, because then I would know... You know, what I like about Twist and Shout as it exists now is it's literally those moments in time. It happened live. It happened at a one-off event. It managed to get captured.
Yeah.
I love a good box set, and I love all that other stuff, but some things don't need light let in on them, you know?
Well, to be fair, that is the song that really just, it suddenly hit me when we were sitting on Abbey Road.
Yeah.
You know, they'd played... lots of other little things. We were wandering around. We were looking at, you know, the pianos and the recorders and things like that.
Yeah.
But it didn't. We'd been in the studio. We
yeah.
looked down at that. All of that. First time it absolutely hit me. What where we were and what was going on and what had happened in this room was hearing Twist and Shout.
And so Twist and Shout had been a showstopper for them. It was the last song they recorded on the night. It's the last song that goes on the album. It's a fantastic song to put at the end of an album, because often on albums, you know, songs tend to have a bit of a melancholy goodbye kind of vibe, whereas to actually end on such a raucous party song. You know, to start with I Saw Her Standing There and to end on Twist and Shout, that's quite a statement of intent. And so they finish recording at about, you know, way after 10 o'clock, at about 10:45. And even still, they don't go home. You know, George Martin and everyone else in the Studio 2 control booth are kind of amazed at how this day has ended. Mm. And they all go into the control room and, you know, an experience that's still relatively new for the Beatles is that they have a playback of, you know, a good number of the songs, and they have a listen to what they're doing, which, again, isn't the behaviour of people who are just in it for a job. You know, it's not like, OK, the session's over at 10, we're going down to the tube station, we're out of here. It's like, you know, something, this is a happening. And, you know, they're kind of recognising that. So I think it was Brian Epstein ended up giving, was it George Martin a lift home or something like that?
Yeah,
or Norman Smith, I think, a lift home. Yeah. So the album itself, you know, it's recorded in February and it comes out about 6 weeks later at the end of March. And in the interim, you know, the other kind of important part is the cover photograph as well.
Yes.
And, you know, it's interesting to see some of the other photos that were taken on that day on the steps of Manchester Square EMI House, because that's the balcony where the photograph got taken. But it was Angus McBean, who was kind of their photographer at the time, who ended up taking that picture. And it's, you know, I think it's as good as you get for that time frame, you know?
I think so. I mean, everything about that photograph is sort of iconic. It's kind of odd that Ringo still has his 1950s Teddy Boy
yes,
quip.
Yes, he hasn't quite signed up to the mop top.
No,
and the little memo
and the little grey streak is visible. But what I like about the photograph is if you kind of strip the you know, the text away from that photograph.
Yeah,
they're on a stairway. That the stairway is kind of stretching up, mm-hmm. you know, almost into infinity.
Mm.
And that's you know, if anybody that went to school in the 60s or the 70s or the 80s. It reminds me of a stairway in a school, like a modern.
Well, it is modern. Yeah,
yeah.
We don't think of this as being modern anymore because of what came after. But this is a modern guys in a modern building.
Yeah. So, and I think that's the thing. If you looked at that, if you got that in 1963, it screams kind of modern future. You know, very much up to date. It's a fantastic photograph. And Angus McBean, last minute. Assignment for him, I think.
Yeah, and again, it's one of these, you know, the thing we talk about over again is Beatles serendipity. You know, just one of these moments. Let's just do this here. You know, it starts with this photo. The photo on the cover of Abbey Road is the same kind of serendipity.
Yep.
It all just works, and of course, they recreate the photo in May 69.
Yes. And the other thing that I really feel I should have known this is that the photograph on the cover of 62, 66, and on the flip side of 67, 70, isn't that photograph.
No, it's slightly different.
It's slightly different. I hadn't quite appreciated that.
But apparently when they were redoing the photo that ended up on the cover of 67, 70, where they recreate the image, Lennon was the most obsessed with trying to recreate
Precisely.
His original angle, position, how he looked, and all the rest.
It could have been. Can we talk about the alternative title?
Oh yes, off the Beatle track.
So it was a narrow escape. It dodged a bullet there. Would their career ever have recovered from off the Beatle track?
I don't think so. I mean, it's interesting that it has a title track. Please, please me. I suppose they're just kind of building on the. On the fame of the single, you know.
So George Martin was a member of the. Zoological Society.
Yes.
So he writes the London Zoo. I mean, he contacts them and says, could we get a photograph of them at the Insect House?
And, another from me.
The Zoological Society wrote back and said, terribly sorry, I don't really think that's quite the image for us. But he used it himself. He put out an orchestral version of Beatles songs and called it Off the Beatle Track. So at least...
I've never actually listened to that. Have you listened to that?
I have. I've heard a few. I've seen it. I've heard a few of the tracks made it onto a Record Store Day release.
But oh, yeah.
I don't have the original. But from I think it's called From Beatles to Bond or Back to Bond or something. So I've heard some of the tracks, but I haven't listened to the whole album.
So, you know, that's the Please Please Me, the debut album from the Beatles. And I think, you know, if you haven't listened to it in a while, go back and dig it out and listen to it again. It is a fantastic piece, and it is an album that changes albums in rock and roll as much as any other album that comes out in the 60s, and it really signifies a start of that era. I do wonder, you know, with all these reissues and everything that are coming out, you know, could they ever do a Please Please Me reissue? I know they have this thing we talked about before, the demixing technology, where they might be able to pull some things off the two-track, but I'm not really sure what else they could put into a Please Please Me super deluxe edition.
I mean, I suppose what you've got are maybe the live versions of songs that ended up on the album.
Yeah.
Maybe you've got those outtakes, early run-throughs, that type of thing. Mm. But it's difficult to see what they would do. Although there are some. So if you, the stereo mix of Please Please Me is a different take to the mono mix of Please Please Me.
Oh really? Okay.
Yeah, completely different take. So Lennon messes up a lyric.
There's a lyric,
line.
Yeah.
So even then, there were sort of, I've never entirely understood how that could possibly happen. That, you know, the different takes are being used for different mixes. Hard to see. Maybe they could fill an entire box set. You know,
where there's a will, there's a way.
Where there's a will, there is a way. But I agree with you. I think this is the album that changed everything, not just for the Beatles, but also, as you say, changed the whole kind of charts, the way the album's charts functioned. Quote from Mark Lewisohn saying, "There can scarcely have been 585 more productive minutes in the history of recorded music." And I think that's a bold statement, but it's hard to maybe disagree with that.
Well, again, here we are 56 years later, pulling it apart and still holding it up to the light. All right. So listen, our main goal is to drive you back to listen to that album one more time and let us know if you've any thoughts on that. So for Nothing Is Real, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And we just want to mention before we go that we are going to be recording a live episode of the Nothing Is Real podcast on November the 3rd, 2019. We're going to be doing it as part of the Dublin Beatles Festival, and we'll be in Bridie's Pub in Marlborough Street in Dublin on the afternoon of November the 3rd, recording an episode. And we are planning to discuss George versus Paul.
Yes, it's pretty one-sided, I think.
I think that'll be maybe our shortest episode. But we would we obviously want as many people as possible in the audience, so you might want to make your travel plans right now. If you go onto Facebook and look up the Dublin Beatles Festival, you will get some details, and we will put out some links on our Twitter feed.
Yes, there are events across the entire weekend, so check out their Facebook page and come along to as many of those as you can make.
Yes, including the Dublin Beatles Festival Beatle Brain of Ireland quiz on the Saturday.
Yes.
Where myself and Stephen will be defending our title, and the winner gets to keep the podcast.
Well, actually we'll not be defending our title.
Well, it's a different format.
They've mixed up the format and they've reverted back to an individual one-on-one.
Yes.
So I will be challenging you, or you will, well, no, I'll be challenging you for the
yes,
it'll
be so there's all that to look forward to.
Again,
so
pretty one-sided.
They always put a lot of effort into this festival, and any support is very welcome. And so look it up on Facebook. We'll put out some links, and we'd love you to come along to the recording of our George versus Paul episode, which we will obviously record and put out at some point in the future if we don't make a total embarrassment of ourselves.
Or fall out irreparably.
All right. So that's it for now. Until the next time, please keep in touch with us. We're on Twitter at BeatlesPod. Join the Facebook group. Just look for Nothing Is Real Podcast on Facebook and you can join us there. Please leave a nice review in whatever podcast app or format that you like to use. And we will see you next time.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.